Like Argo, if Argo was a real Star Wars ripoff. In honor of the disaster artist, what movie deserves a movie about how that movie was made?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm just going to go ahead and go with Justice League, which I haven't even seen, but was such a mishigas behind the scenes with its two directors and many different stars and Henry Cavill mustache that I'd like to see how it all happened.
Yeah, just the whole saga of the mustache, I think.
The mustache, mostly about the mustache, please.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with a movie that I was revisiting the other day called Roar, the 1981 drama-ish thing devised by Tippi Hedren and her husband Noel Marshall that took them 11 years to film on their ranch in California with a bunch of lions, because they love lions, except those lions ended up injuring like 70 people over the course of that 11-year shoot, including their daughter, Melanie Griffith, who was mauled in the face and required reconstructive surgery. Fun!
And it's me, David the Seven, who says El Mariachi, which is also a pretty entertaining set of diaries that Robert Rodriguez later published as his book, Rebel Without a Crew. But it's like them making a $2,000 movie in Mexico and then writing that to being discovered in Hollywood. And not a whole bunch of sex monster stuff along the way, which in hindsight is really nice for that time period.
Sex monster. Nice.
Sex Great. Monsters, Inc.
That's part of the Shape of Water, guys.
Oh, boy.
Spoiler alert.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine, too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 192. It's Tuesday, November 28th, and on this day in 1997, the last episode of the original run of Beavis and Butthead aired, which seems crazy because I feel like that was on my entire childhood. But
I'm sure it was just reruns.
Was on your entire childhood?
It just feels like it was just always there. But I guess at some point it transitioned into South Park, and I just kind of never.
I think we've talked about this on the podcast, but I was very scared of Beavis and Butthead as a child.
Have we talked about this?
They still haunt my memories, the scraggly lines and the giggling. Ugh.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite.
I have a Beavis and Butthead original animation cell on my wall right behind my computer right now.
From the show?
I'm looking at it. Yep, it's got a certificate of authenticity from MTV and everything.
Wow, you're made to work at MTV?
Sometimes, yeah, working at Viacom for almost a decade has little perks.
Very little.
David is not with us this week, so he's not here to badger you about how you should leave us reviews, but you should leave us reviews.
You can imagine him badgering you.
Yeah. He'll be back to report about his star-studded night at the Gotham Awards, which is where he is right now.
All I could tell from tweets is that he's drunk and there are awards being given out.
Yep. Patches, have you been to the Gotham Awards?
I have been. I sat at a table with F. Murray Abraham for the evening, wining and dining and talking about the Grand Budapest Hotel. It was a wonderful night.
That's wonderful.
That sounds
I
great,
saw John
actually.
Hamm, and I gave him a handshake. Someone dared me to go up and gave him a handshake. We gave him a handshake.
I think we were there the same night, but I was at a table full of people from a perfume company, and I just remember it being incredibly long.
Not as fun as F. Murray Abraham.
No, definitely not as fun.
No. Talking to F. Murray Abraham about Grand Budapest Hotel sounds like a reward that you get at a charity auction.
It was actually a scene from Wes Anderson's new movie. That's how quirky it was.
Actually, I think you won Make-A-Wish.
Yeah.
It's the dream.
Oh. Patches, it sometimes happens on the show. You tweeted something and I decided to make you talk about it on a podcast. but I thought you made a really interesting point about two movies that are out in theaters right now that we have talked about on and off for months now. Call Me By Your Name and Lady Bird, which are both about teenagers and both are rated R for, I'd say, pretty different reasons. These films have some similarities, including a member of the cast, but like aren't really the same kind of movie. But you are arguing that they are movies that teenagers absolutely should see that now they can't. And I'm curious about why you think they're so important for teenagers to see.
Well, there's a few things on my mind when I tweeted that out. One, my general frustration with the MPAA. I've been thinking a lot about the MPAA recently because it's actually, well, Katie, you definitely know this. It's the 20th anniversary of your of a good movie. What movie is coming out? 20 years old.
I assume you mean Titanic, but I don't remember it having anything to do with the MPAA.
I'll tell you why it has to do with the MPAA. This is a particular fascination. I sent someone on this, and we didn't. And actually, Vanity Fair ran a new interview with James Cameron that highlighted this point that's been getting to me. So 20 years ago, James Cameron did not have to do pretty much anything to get this topless shot of Kate Winslet. This life-changing shot for many of us. I just want to throw that out there. I know that sounds skeezy, but come on. This was like 13-year-olds, teenagers.
I don't want to, you know, mythologize it into life-changing for me necessarily, sure. But I do remember it being a talking point that it was a PG-13 movie
it was
with
a
that scene
moment.
In it.
Yes, it was a PG-13 movie with topless Kate Winslet, and it was a whoa moment. And
dial-up speed was slow. Boobs were not as easy to find back then.
I'm just saying it was. I was with my mom and my sister seeing Titanic, probably begrudgingly, because it was so popular. Every girl at school had seen it, and I'm sitting through Titanic. I'm like, oh my God. And now I look back at that
now
moment.
Now I am a man.
Yes, now I'm a man. I look back at that moment, and I just think, what did he get away with? Because sex and nudity are, you know, even the slightest insinuation of sexuality can get a movie an R rating. But of course, then you have like Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, with the murder of millions and just gruesome, horrible, nightmarish visions. That's PG-13 material. You know, we've always had this discrepancy. And I wanted to go searching for like the story of how James Cameron got this to happen. And after contacting the MPAA and then also reading an interview that just ran on Vanity Fair, of Rebecca, Keegan, the great Rebecca Keegan, who wrote a book on James Cameron that everyone should read. She interviewed him and asked this question, which has been on my mind. And we both came up with the same answer, basically, which was the MPAA just didn't care. Like, I contacted the MPAA and they're like, actually, it wasn't really a big deal. He just wrote a nice letter. James Cameron is James Cameron. And we let it slide. He said it was art. We decided it was art. It's art. Nudity equal art. And that's basically what Cameron says, too. Like, he doesn't remember it being a big fight. He just said, we're doing it for artistic reasons, and it happened. And that's kind of staggering to me, because I don't feel like we've had... Can you think of another moment, either of you, that stands out, like a defiant moment in MPAA oversight or censorship?
I remember Harvey Weinstein going to battle with the MPAA as a publicity stunt constantly. Like, the most prominent example I remember is Blue Valentine, which was given an X rating because it had a scene of oral sex, which I remember the controversy coming up after I had seen the movie, and I couldn't remember it actually being that crazy. But I think he successfully argued it down to an R, if I remember it correctly. But that's the thing. Like, once you're older than 17, you kind of think of the MPAA ratings exclusively as publicity things and not about, like, not as relevant to your movie-going experience, which right. I think your point, Patches, is that for a lot of people it is really relevant.
Yeah, and I just don't see the legacy of Titanic informing the artistic merits of sexuality in movies and earning a PG-13 rating. How does Titanic get a PG-13 and a movie like Lady Bird, which I believe has an R rating mostly because of glimpses of Playgirl magazine and the use of the C word? I won't say it here.
I would imagine profanity is what puts Lady Bird over the edge.
Insane.
So on a moral level, sure, it's insane, but this nudity or profanity is one of the few things where the MPAA kind of has a clear line. Like, you get one use of fuck kind of as an interjection, and then you're out. Whether or not that's right is
the lines are
fair, but it's clear at least.
Yeah, the lines are clear, but the lines are idiotic. And
sure.
The lines need to be redrawn, because when a film like Lady Bird, which shows no explicit material, is slapped with an R rating, they're doing a disservice, even though after I tweeted this, many people reminded me that it's easy to sneak into an R-rated movie, and kids do it all the time. But to be quite honest, as someone who struggled to get into the Matrix sequels back in the day, when they were right on the cusp, ready to be let in, I feel the pain, because you can get blocked, and people do get blocked, to the point where, like, a movie like Blue is the Warmest Color, which is all about teen sexuality and
that definitely
yourself.
Was NC-17.
Yeah, that was. Was it?
You
might be right.
That has
insane
sex scenes.
Yeah, the sex scenes are crazy. But I remember that the IFC, at least IFC Center here in the city, I don't know if other theaters around the country followed this, but they lifted their age restrictions. They said mm-hmm. that any teenager could go see this movie, and they didn't care. Like, they were ready to take the hit from, I don't know who would come after them. I actually don't know how that works, if the MPA could try and, you know, slap them on the wrists.
No, see, that's the thing.
I don't think
that's the most frustrating thing, is this is all imposed by, you know, the thought that people will not go to a theater that doesn't
right.
show MPAA,
you just don't want angry
like,
parents.
Licensed movies. Which, yeah, which is, it's gonna, there's a real possibility in this time in theater going that we could push back against something like this with more, like, art house types theaters. Like, I know that, you know, there's, like, all sorts of different, you know, family-friendly screenings of things. People could just start letting kids into, like, R-rated movies if they wanted, if the theater was willing to, like, put their reputation on the line. I don't think the MPAA would do anything about it.
Hmm. I mean, but there's so few theaters that aren't, like, AMC or Regal or Lowe's that, like, really are enthralled to the MPAA, that you'd have to be a smaller chain like the Draft House or a totally independent theater to be willing to take that gamble.
But you still have parents who are following these guidelines, too. It's not just the theaters. I mean, maybe I lived a very sheltered life where, for a long time, I was like, no, you're not allowed to see an R-rated movie. You're not old enough to see an R-rated movie. And I'm sure there's plenty of people out there.
I think that's still healthy, but it's like, once you're, like, IDing people at the theater, then that shifted to the theater enforcing it, which I don't think is even in the spirit of what the system was invented for.
Well, and you think, like, of the way that television has kind of blown, like, television introduced ratings, like, we were in middle school, I think, but it's kind of blown past it entirely with all of premium cable. I mean, how many teenagers are watching Game of Thrones on a regular basis and seeing stuff that they would never be able to buy a ticket to, and how few of those teenagers right. are even bothering to go to the movies anyway. Like, the idea that you're protecting teenagers from seeing stuff that their parents don't want them to see by not selling them a movie ticket is really outdated at this point.
Well, then do you think I'm overreacting about complaining about the R rating on Lady Bird and Call Me By Your Name, or is it, it's pointless at this point? The R rating is superfluous. No one is looking at these ratings anymore, and everyone can see this movie if they want to.
I think it's an indication of how outdated the system has become. Like, you've got a system that's blocking movies like that from teenagers who are, you know, might seek it out on VOD or sneak into it, but it's just kind of one more hurdle of getting to a movie. I mean, I think ratings are really ratings for movie showing in theaters are useful for parents that say, like, I'll be in 3 years, or I'll have a preschooler and want to know if it's a G or a PG movie, like what level of scariness it will have for a kid. And I think that can you know, apply to parents up to their kids are like 14 or so. But after that, I think it's kind of pointless.
To be my own. No, sorry, go.
Okay, I think it is a system that was designed before the internet, when it wasn't as easy to have another non-official association source that you trust, be it a friend or a blog or a print outlet that is able to tell you the context of a movie and whether it's good for your kids. I think it's a good way to categorize now in terms of if there are hard rules, even if they are ridiculous rules, you know, the difference between PG-13 and R could just be a number of fucks if it says strong language there on the label. So if you know how you're reading your label, I still think it can be a useful system. It is really insane, the idea that someone could deny you entry to something you bought a ticket for right. because of a non-official age restriction, but that's more against the theater than I think it is against the MPAA at this point.
You know, another question for you, Patch, is if you had a 13-year-old, would you take them to see Call Me By Your Name?
A 13-year-old?
Yeah.
I
guess 13 isn't quite high school, so maybe 14.
Yeah, I would. This is more like a 15, 16-year-old movie for me.
Yeah.
More than a 13-year-old movie. I don't think Lady Bird is a 13-year-old movie either, necessarily. Well, what I was about to say, I was about to play my own devil's advocate here. Is Lady Bird and cooler because it's R-rated? You know, we get so much kind of watered-down teen garbage that more people might seek Lady Bird out because it's a movie about teenagers that is R-rated and can be hard. And this also made me think of a very sad but funny story that Mean Girls director Mark Waters told me for our big props project over at Thrillist, which was, you know, it's kind of a famous story, but there was a little more depth to it, which about the making of the Burn book. Are you familiar with this story? That, you know, besides it having to be super pink and super evil, you know, there's all these awful, awful comments made in the book. And one of them is Amber D'Alessio made out with a hot dog. That was not supposed to be the joke. The original joke
makes no sense.
Yeah, it makes absolutely no sense. The original joke, as Tina Fey wrote it, was Amber D'Alessio masturbated with a frozen hot dog. Okay, and then the ratings board, the MPAA, said they could not use that. So they changed it to made out with a frozen hot dog. And then the MPAA was still going to give them an R rating because their problem was frozen.
Wow.
So it became made out with a hot dog. And there was this whole thing later in the movie where they kind of cut down on this Amber D'Alessio masturbation joke. They sacrificed that in order to keep a use of the word vagina later. If you recall, there's an assembly scene where they're talking about like lady problems.
I have a wide set vagina and a heavy flow.
There you go. So they weren't allowed to use the word vagina. And then Tina Fey and Mark Waters apparently teamed up and they were like chastising the MPAA about how Will Ferrell could have like an erect penis in Anchorman. That's what Mark Waters, his reference. And how dare they slam women for using the word vagina in their movie. So they got the word vagina in during the assembly scene by making concessions on masturbating with a frozen hot dog. And frozen was the problem. I think that's unbelievable. But Mean Girls, you know,
it makes a lot more sense in terms of physics, but, you know.
It's also a lot more dangerous that way because if you've ever put your tongue against a frozen flagpole.
It's a Christmas story too. Yeet. But Mean Girls is a very good movie. It's probably one of the best teen movies ever made. But I think Lady Bird is already kind of in that pack without doing too much work. But I wonder if Mean Girls would be even better if it was R-rated and if Lady Bird excels and is cooler for being R-rated.
Mean Girls.
Cooler than Mean Girls.
Mean Girls being better if it's R-rated is something I never thought about. I feel like it has to be true, even though Tina Fey made 7 Seasons of 30 Rock all within network TV guidelines, which are probably similarly strict and made
a lot
of hilarious stuff.
Well, the innuendo hoops that 30 Rock jumps
and
through
I think,
of beauty.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of what made it so funny.
I mean, I don't know. They're different tones, but I do think Lady Bird is cooler for being R, and I don't think... I'm not too worried about people seeing it, because even if this theater thing does turn out to be a problem, I think it's going to have some non-theatrical legs and discovery, which is going to be just as good for those people.
Well, I guess I'm even more pissed off that Call Me By Your Name is R-rated, because there's really not that... there's not a ton of explicit material in it. I guess there's some, like... there's younger person nudity in the movie, and maybe that is what
I'm not sure if I've ever seen a PG-13 movie with like very obvious blowjobs in it.
There's not a very obvious blowjob.
There's
in Call
two. There's like two very clear scenes of oral sex in that movie.
Whoa.
I mean, it's not explicit, but it's very clear what's happening.
Yes, you see the back of a head
twice
as it's taking on another head. Twice? I don't want to get into the details here, but...
You're wondering why the frozen hot dog people didn't let that through?
I'm just saying, we talked about this with 3D weeks and weeks ago, but come on, James Cameron. You're supposed to be saving cinema here. Where is the legacy of Titanic when it comes to Call Me By Your Name?
Well, his argument that he said to Rebecca Keegan is that he made the point that it was sensual but not erotic. It's not a sex scene. They don't have sex until significantly later in the movie. I think that's how they got away with it.
But they still have sex in the movie. They have the steamiest. That's like a super duper steamy
scene. Call Me By Your
scene.
Name also has like full frontal female nudity.
So does Titanic.
No, Titanic has only her breasts. You don't see her genitals.
No, you don't see her genitals in Call Me By Your Name.
Yes, you do. You see her totally get naked.
I'm gonna have to go back to the tape on that one. And
man, we're like wait a this Mr. movie comes
Skin
out in Denver.
Podcast. And exactly 40 minutes in,
I'm looking at it for the articles. Okay, I'm looking at it for the articles. Anyway, this got really dark. I guess what I'm saying is,
there are blowjobs in Call Me By Your Name.
To see these movies. I mean, they're so important. I rewatched Call Me By Your Name this week. I think it's a masterpiece. We'll talk about it more, I'm guessing. But I really do. I just want young people to have movie going experiences or like humanistic experiences There's just so much crap.
Patches. Hell, Patches. Kids go to movies. The entire Justice League united for the first time.
Six for the six.
On the big screen.
That's, yeah, you're right. I want to end this segment by just saying, release Zack Snyder's cut of Justice League. I know it's rated
Save
R,
the kids.
But the kids will see it.
That's not the theme anymore.
Apparently,
but
William
it's
Shatner
not unlike
Jason
the theme.
Isaacs on Twitter.
What?
Sorry, am I talking over your intro? I was just saying that William Shatner blocked Jason Isaacs on Twitter. I think that's funny.
Oh,
anyway,
man,
go.
Let's not talk about the war of the actual captains, because William Shatner is so sad. I had to block William Shatner being that sad. Anyway, not important, because we're going to talk about Star Trek Discovery, which is currently in its mid-season break for CBS All Access. It is the newest Star Trek show since Star Trek Enterprise went off the air, like, God knows who how long ago. I wasn't watching Enterprise while I was actually broadcasting. That's one of the shows you pick up with in the tail run. It's been a long time since Star Trek has been on TV. J.J. Abrams rebooted it on screen in the interim, but now it's back, and it's locked behind a paywall on CBS All Access, their streaming app, which means you have to do that in order to be a Star Trek fan. Not only that, but Star Trek Discovery is playing it loose and fast with Star Trek lore and Star Trek's dependence on what used to be previous science.
We talked a little about the pilot when it aired. We somehow snuck that by David and got that on here, but since David is gone... We're briefly going to talk about how this all wrapped up and if it's successful.
Well, it hasn't
maybe,
wrapped up. It's,
well, no, okay.
It's halfway through.
It's taken a deep breath. It's taken a deep
it's
breath.
It's definitely successful by CBS's All Access standards. They've met their goal for the end of the season by now in terms of new subscribers. They were looking for CBS All Access or for Star Trek Discovery to bring to All Access, and they've greenlit a second season for Discovery on All Access. So we know that we're stuck with Star Trek Discovery for a little bit. It's been interesting to see the fandom react, as this is the first Star Trek series to say fuck. This is the first Star Trek series to have a gay couple. And this is the first Star Trek series to center around mushroom space travel.
Wait, you forgot about the Klingon sex scene.
Oh, there was also a Klingon sex scene.
Klingon,
yeah, Klingon nipples.
Yeah. Wow. That was something.
I feel like I sound like a huge creep on this episode. You are picking out a lot of the interesting parts.
It just came at me out of nowhere. Like, what? I didn't expect that. I forgot. I forgot that All Access is truly All Access.
It's been interesting for me, at least, to watch the fandom react to it from the people who are super not happy that they're taking, liberties with the Star Trek timeline. Both with how advanced certain things should be and terms for, you know, cloaking device versus invisibility shield or whatever they're calling it now.
People seem super upset about the Klingon redesign. Like, why change that? I'm in no camp here. I don't care. My big explanation for all changes in Star Trek canon are, bear with me here. So the original series of Star Trek was like a telling of history. You know, if you were making a movie about the history of something, you would still interpret true facts to bring your vision alive with the technology that you have of the 60s, late 60s. And Discovery is the same thing, except it's doing with modern technology. You see what I'm getting at? It's a period piece, but about the future. But you can only tell it in the technology that you have. That's why it changes. It would never be the same year to year.
There's a sort of similar theory that Lucasfilm's Pablo Hidalgo has proposed on Twitter for people to get really nitpicky about Star Wars canon, which is that, the Death Star blew up Alderaan, and on the bridge was Vader and Leia and Grand Moff Tarkin. They're all standing in close proximity on a giant bridge because it's being shot for a film and they all need to be in frame at the same time so you see the reactions. So the canon thing is that these things happened. How we're presented with them for each fictional retelling is, like you're saying, bound by the medium in which it's told. But yeah, it's Star Trek Discovery. It's going to be back in January for its second half. If you haven't picked it up, like my father, we have to have a little talk about how much you miss Star Trek. Because if you miss Star Trek whatsoever, this will press certain buttons. Whether those buttons are, oh, I'm so glad Star Trek's back on TV and we have science fiction like this again. Or whether it's, this is not my Star Trek, but my Star Trek is streaming somewhere right now. I should go rewatch that. I think both are good reactions.
Here's the big selling point to wrap up our little mini segment here. This, I want to convince Katie to buy into Star Trek All Access or CBS All Access and watch Star Trek. Katie.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Sonequa Martin-Green?
I watched the first episode of Star Trek because we talked about it. And she's
great.
But
I'm saying you got to get to the end because she's a star in the making. Let me pitch you for Vanity Fair cover, perhaps. I know
yes,
you're in charge.
Yes, I am
of
in charge
things.
Of that, of course.
Michael Burr, I had a huge fight with our colleague, Jordan Hoffman of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. You can listen to that show. I don't know when, but it will be up soon. It's a two-parter for some godforsaken reason. But
were there like five of you on that podcast?
Yes. It's a hoot. But we argued about Michael Burnham, the main character of this, you know, of this new show. She's not the captain. I don't think she actually has a role on the ship. Dave, am I wrong about that? She is a felon, and she's been recruited by Captain.
She keeps even giving new roles depending on like what things open up. I think she's actually like a head science officer now for the weaponry research project that became the tardigrade project. So maybe she's also without a role now. Yeah, she's floating around every man convict.
But my question, so I got in an argument with Jordan about if Michael Burnham is a rich character or if she is flat, because Michael Burnham is a human who is raised by Vulcans. As we know, as Katie knows, Vulcans are very logical people. And they don't express much emotion because that stands in the way of truth versus fiction. So Michael Burnham is trying to get used to like having human emotions. And you know, in this first two-parter episode, she makes this kind of crazy decision to kind of take on the Klingons, go against her captain. She gives her captain a Vulcan neck pinch in order to override her and mutiny to go to battle with Klingons. And she starts this war. Whether she could have prevented it or not is a question. But, you know, she's locked up and then she winds up, long story short, aboard this ship, the Discovery, and now everyone hates her, and she's just trying to climb back into good graces, but also an understanding of human emotion. For some reason, Jordan thought this was a flat character, but Dave, I want to get your opinion here. Is Michael Burnham a rich character that Katie could invest in on television? Does she have places to go? Is she going in a direction?
She has places to go, and it's an intriguing direction because the part that you're leaving out is she's technically Spock's half-sibling or partial sibling. No, adopted sibling, I guess would be the way to put it. Spock, who is half Vulcan, half human, who sets the archetype for Star Trek characters where each crew has a fish-out-of-water species where the, you know, humor or plot point is mined with them adapting to that the Star Trek culture, whatever time period it's in. Discovery thus far has switched that for a more soap opera-y drama drive because they're such a limited series. They're doing arcs that are, you know, feel like they're building somewhere. So because of that, not only is she somewhat related to Spock, but she actually got part of Sarek, Spock's dad's soul, which is something that Spock only had in like biologically. He didn't have this Katra transfer, which potentially places her to be like the hero in the sense that the Vulcans are the parents you could never replace even if you're perfect, or you could never impress even if you're perfect. And not only that, but she feels the emotions that they're supposedly hiding.
It's a lot like Lady Bird.
Those things are interesting. I mean, it could be. It depends how much they lean into her being a convict and how much that makes sense at the end of whatever narrative they're doing. If they just send her back to prison at the end of this, then she would have been an interesting protagonist, but I don't think they fully executed what the character is.
That would be crazy. Well, Katie, there's a Groundhog Day episode, so I hope that sells you.
Hey, I do like a time loop. A ton of really good movies that are worth talking about, which is what makes this time of year so crazy, is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which is in some level of release that Dave got to see it in his open where I live, so it's outside of New York and L.A. It's a new film from Martin McDonagh, who is the Irish filmmaker and playwright who won an Oscar for a short film before he ever made a feature, which is what's funny. He's an Oscar-winning filmmaker whose best-known films have not won any Oscars. But he is he's the filmmaker of In Bruges, which did it get a screenplay win anyway? In Bruges was very critically acclaimed, and Seven Psychopaths, and now he's made this film, which stars Frances McDormand as this woman who, as is very explicitly stated in the titular billboards, her daughter was raped and murdered, and the police in town, in this small town called Ebbing, Missouri, have 8 months later not been able to make any arrests or find out who did it. So she decides to buy these derelict billboards and basically put the police chief on the spot about why this crime hasn't been solved. The police chief is played by Woody Harrelson, whose role in the film is really interesting, and we may choose to want to get into spoilers to be able to talk about how he fits into the story in general. Then he also has a deputy played by Sam Rockwell, who's kind of a classic Sam Rockwell nincompoop with a added dash of racism, which is also very relevant to where the story goes.
Potent.
I feel like if you've heard about the movie, you've probably heard about Frances McDormand's performance. She has kind of carved out this role for herself. I guess she kind of always has, like, even since Fargo, as this just, like, incredibly tough, like, no bullshit, but human woman. She's not like a super, she's not always quippy. She's not always right. She doesn't have like superpowers. She's just this like strong headed woman. And the rest of the cast is really amazing. When I was seeing the movie, I kept being like, oh, okay, well, you know, and all the great actors who were in this have shown up. And then Clark Peters from The Wire shows up, or John Hawks. It's a really stacked cast. And you can tell why people want to work with Martin McDonagh, because he writes these intricate screenplays with really great dialogue. There are, you know, scenes that just kind of fly along. But what the film is about more than the characters are telling the story of this town is kind of the general concept of forgiveness and what it means to forgive and move on and find redemption, that it's really tricky. And I'm not super sure that it pulls off most of what it's going for beyond the great Frances McDormand performance. And I feel weird because I came out really mixed on this movie, and then I see people who just absolutely love it. And then there are people who absolutely hate it. It brings out a big variety of reactions, which I think we have represented on this show.
I feel like
too.
I'm seeing an uptick in the latter in recent
weeks.
In
what?
Weeks.
In hating it?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like there's been some strong negative
reactions. The backlash to the backlash to the backlash always happens.
It does. Tis the season for such things.
Dave,
what
who
did
feels
you
like they like it the most?
Liked it the most? That's probably
liked
me.
Liked it the most? That's Patches.
Yeah, okay.
That's me. I guess I found the venting to be quite cathartic. I don't know if this is a movie about forgiveness. I feel like reading it as such could make people really upset because certain people, especially after this this Nazi editorial, white nationalist editorial that went up on the New York Times, it had some people, you know, threatening to quit or to cancel their New York Times subscription because the New York Times was normalizing Nazism, and then other people trying to defend the article, you know, by saying that you got to write about these people to expose them, and you have to like get into their heads to figure out why they exist at all. And should we tell, you know, you had Ira Glass tweeting about this New York Times article in the face of all these people hating it, being like, you know, do you want us to tell you exactly how to feel about everything or how to think about everything? And I thought about that article and thought about Three Billboards a little bit, that it's exposing a lot of nastiness on all sides of the line. On the sympathetic characters are nasty. I mean, I don't know if Mildred, Frances McDormand's character, I mean, she commits crimes in this movie. She is on a path of vengeance to, She doesn't want to just find out who killed, raped her daughter. She wants to hold them all accountable. She wants them to be dead. And she wants the people who failed her, the police, to be, you know, dragged across the lawn until they figure out who did it. And everyone's held accountable. And in doing so, she, you know, burns down a building and she comes after people and she goes crazy. She's not necessarily a sympathetic character. She has mental issues. And not just mental issues, but just emotional issues that she needs to overcome, and she needs to do them through physical ways. But then, of course, you have someone like Sam Rockwell's character, who is a blatant racist. He has a reputation for, like, beating up black people, and he just has violent tendencies that aren't limited by race either. He, at one point, just beats up someone he can't stand, who, you know, these billboards are making all the emotion in everyone bubble up, and people are having outbursts to just people in the street. They just beat the shit out of each other. It's complete madness in this town, you know, begat by other madness. And I kept drawing lines in the past 24, 48 hours to this editorial of the New York Times. It's just like, do you expose these people to better understand them? And I think that's where the movie ultimately goes. I don't think it's about forgiveness to these people. It's about understanding where certain people come from. And maybe some people are human deep down. You know, Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell come closer. You know, maybe we talk about spoilers. You mentioned this, Katie. I don't know how spoilery we can get with the movie. It's just kind of going wide.
Let me
now,
say something, but, and then we could get into actual spoilers, because I think it's important to.
Yeah, I definitely.
For, at least
need to
for
be able
me to sort
about,
out some stuff.
Yeah, same.
But my blunt reaction to this is I'm fascinated by the way McDonough makes these people talk and makes them interact, and how their anger demonstrates itself through, you know, noble behavior and through disgusting behavior, and it's all caught up in, it's all orbiting the same event. And I find that, you know, that is the world that we're living in today, and it captures something. It's a microcosm. And I found it very fascinating. And of course, it can be very hilarious at times, too, and tragic. I just got really caught up in it.
Dave.
Yeah. I liked it, but I'm having some trouble digesting it, because it's either a movie about forgiveness that ultimately wants... it's a movie about forgiveness that I ultimately disagree with. How about that? At the end, or it's a movie about how, like, even what feels like a noble reaction to a tragedy is ultimately binding you to it more than acceptance of that tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something that happens halfway through the movie that we'll talk about a little bit later on that triggers the reaction in the non-Mildred people, so that everybody's in this state where they're not thinking rationally. They just want blood, sometimes literally. And that drives most of their characters to a conclusion. And there's lots of parallels of different people dealing with different traumas and how they do that, some in stereotypical ways that I think are played for comedy, and other ways that are sort of shrugged off, like Sam Rockwell's character's torturing of a black man in custody that sort of like goes to the side. And I'm not sure how I feel about that being used as like a set dressing to that particular character.
Yeah, it happens before the movie starts, as we're saying. It's mentioned but not depicted. So it's right. It's kind of even more set dressing in that way.
And then
it's
felt
throughout the movie. I mean, it's very palpable. This incident is not set dressing. He's interacting with multiple black people who are authority figures in his life and passerbys in his life who are all judging him for this. This is not something he can escape. He's so aware of his own mishaps that he has become woke through this. He's like, you can't say these things. He's such a weird combination of woke culture and feminine
saying
racism.
Saying he's become woke through this seems... not,
but he's talking. He's lecturing. Either. He lectures Woody Harrelson's character about language.
Yeah,
and
isn't he being sarcastic when he does that?
No. I don't think he's being sarcastic.
That's what
at
I'm
all.
Saying. I don't believe that as a character trait that would be exhibited by a real character or a real person.
Well, that's
I don't
where,
believe
that's
the narrative.
Then. This is not about real people. These are stand-ins for emotions.
Wait, but I thought you were saying you get so caught up in like the way that it's depicting our world.
Yeah, if you're like, if your point is like, shouldn't we draw these people out, then like, draw out the real people. Don't draw out a parable about how some racists just don't know any better, which is what I'm saying. If that's what this movie's ultimately getting towards the end, which it feels like it's leaning towards, then it's a movie I disagree with that's using the rape and murder of a young girl and the torture of a black man as these stepping stones to make us feel a certain way at the end that is not based on the reality of who these people are, but is based on like a, here, your heroes are gonna do the hero thing.
Wow, I don't feel that way at all about the ending. I mean, I guess we'll get there with the spoilers, but it's just like not my read of the film at all. And to suggest that these people have to be like realistic, real humans to speak to the truth of a situation that we are in as society, I just find that bizarre. Like,
but what about the way the movie is structured makes it feel like, I mean, it's filmed in a small town. It's like, it's a realistically depicted movie in every way. Like, it's going for authenticity and character, as most movies are.
I guess I disagree. Do you find all Coen Brothers movies to be very realistic with like real people in them?
I mean, I think authenticity of character is a different thing, Lowe. That, like, I don't know that all the characters in Fargo necessarily feel like people I know, but they are characters who do things that make sense and who have motivations. And I feel like a three Billboards lacked that a lot of times for me.
I mean, it's like the same motivation that in my mind would make somebody torture a black person in custody while being an officer in the law makes me make assumptions about who that character is. That's why it's there. It's quick setting character development. What I'm saying is my conceptualization of what that is, given what's happening in the current landscape, doesn't mean a person that I want to see do the acts that he does later on. Like,
when it makes it impossible for you to regard him as a character you want to root for in any way or be invested in.
You're not supposed to root for any of these people, especially by the end.
You start rooting for Sam Rockwell at a certain point, I'd say.
There's the narratives built around you rooting for Sam Rockwell at a certain point.
I think I agree with that, but not by the end.
So, okay, maybe not by the end. And the end being ambiguous is what makes me on the fence about this movie. It could be, you know, a brilliant attempt at something that just didn't work for me. Or it could be like weird fucking mythologizing about, you know, a town in Missouri that's never going to exist, that's tragedy porn, that sidesteps the real issues of gender and race to tell a story about white people feeling better about themselves.
Wow.
It could be either one of those things, depending on like your reading of it, which I think makes it at least worth somebody taking a look at. I just was unable to interpret it the first time through. I feel really mixed about it right now.
Yeah, Dave, I feel less caught up in it being a story about white people and how they deal with themselves about race. I think it's tackling that a little bit better. But I do think the decision to have made Sam Rockwell someone who isn't just a racist, but who has actually, abused his power as a policeman to attack black people is a really fatal mistake. It just hits too closely on a nerve that everyone's really grappling with right now, that Martin McDonagh definitely knew we were grappling with. And I think as a non-American, didn't realize how tough it would be to swallow. And I think it makes it so that it's set up in a way where it's this background detail about the character. I mean, Patches, you point out that it's brought up for him by other people throughout the movie, but it doesn't seem like that is so essential that it couldn't have been something else that wouldn't have made it loom so large over the rest of the story and could made it easier for that character to exist on the terms of what he actually does in the movie, which I think is way more interesting than making him just another racist cop who beats up black people, which we have so many of.
I mean, we do have a lot of them. Isn't that the whole point, that these people exist in everyday society? I don't understand why this is a fault of the movie for depicting something that is real.
Because it's such a gigantic thing that the movie doesn't really grapple with.
But that's the whole point, that these people do these things and then they move on with their life. That it's not, you know, we live in a bubble where we're like hyper sensitive and scrutinizing every single
moment, and we think that all these people are held accountable, but our news cycle moves on to the next thing where we don't go back to these people and they have real lives and they continue on. And all this racism in the country is not something that gets called out and shut down every time it's exposed. It's something that lives and lingers, and you have real people doing these real things, and those people can suddenly be slightly heroic at certain times depending on the context.
So yeah, you're building a narrative. You're building a narrative about him moving on from things that happen within the story, so why not build a narrative around him actually dealing with that part of his story, too? I mean, you're telling a story.
Because that's not the story.
I know, but that indicates to me that Martin McDonagh wants to use this very real, painful thing as just kind of a shock value element of a character and not actually grapple with it, which I think is irresponsible.
But how is he not grappling with it by building it into the character? Why do you demand that the story of this movie confront that notion? It can be his backstory. That is life. That is life.
Because in this movie, his greater crime ultimately at the end is that he was an idiot. Like, I disagree with that narrative. Like, even when the movie builds him up to be a racist, maybe because his mom is, like, you know, crazy, like Katie's saying, they don't deal with this race-based power crime. They instead punish him as a character for being an idiot.
But why would they deal with this race-based crime when it has nothing to do with the story that is being told?
Why is it in the movie?
Why is it telling him he's an idiot?
It's because he walks into the story with this life. You're like judging him on a moral level and saying that that is a judgment of the movie. But like, just because he has this backstory and he runs into it several times, people judge him. They make jokes about the torturing of the black guy.
What are you talking about? How he wasn't held accountable to it.
One of the men who helps Frances McDormand's character put up the billboards is a black person who is suspect of all of them for just like the way they behave. And then he can ignore these people. He can ignore their endless hate for each other by, you know, finding a girl that he's interested in, having a conversation with her at the bar and enjoying his life.
The only other black person in town.
Who gets arrested by the racist cop, and then nobody brings that up. It's not a great look
because
you're bringing all sorts of different context to the
movie with white and black people in it that takes place in Missouri.
No. I mean, you should bring race to it because the movie brings race to it. But what I'm saying is just because it's built into his character doesn't mean that's the story that demands to be told. The whole point is that he's bringing this baggage in, and he's more complicated than this one act of heroism that he displays. I mean, maybe we should get into spoilers at some point so we can actually talk in specifics about the things that happen in this movie, because I feel like we're centering on one aspect of it that is hanging you guys up.
I just think there's too much baggage on that aspect of the character that they introduce for the rest of the movie to be able to get around it. It just seems like a misstep.
I feel like we're policing this movie a little bit with like weird, I mean, societal context that obviously is
but it's a movie about society. That's what you were just saying.
No, you're right. But I feel like you're making moral judgments instead of playing by the movie, like experiencing the movie. You're halting
it. No, I'm judging Martin McDonagh's choice to include this in his screenplay.
But like, I don't feel like you're grappling with why he chose it. You're just saying that he doesn't pay it off. That aspect of it doesn't get its own storyline, so it must be a failure.
If the movie's like has heroes at any point, then the movie's a failure because these people are heroes.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if the movie has heroes, especially.
Well, that's the point.
The
if the moral
I mean,
of the
Mildred...
movie is we're all fucked for feeling, then I kind of think it's brilliant.
But don't you think
that
this movie is about a mother failing in her pursuit to get justice for her daughter? Like, what's interesting is that she fails her son, played by Lucas Hedges, who is depressed and who is tormented at school. She is ruining his life by her endless anger over this situation. And obviously her anger, in some ways, at the beginning of the movie at least, we think it's noble, that it's good. She should hold these people accountable. It feels, I don't know, this whole movie feels like Twitter to me.
Oh boy.
I mean, you're getting close to sort of what I was saying at the beginning, which is interesting. But we should move into spoilers for a little bit so we could talk about some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Now.
So what's the spoiler?
The spoiler is that what they say to Francis McDormand really early in the movie, but isn't in reviews or trailers, is that Woody Harrelson's character has pancreatic cancer and is dying. So he's the target of her billboards and is kind of this instantly sympathetic figure because he's a dying man and everyone in town knows about it. And she decides not to take down the billboards. And then probably the halfway point in the movie, he kills himself kind of to avoid a long illness. And so that character is taken out of the story.
How about that scene
Wait, can we talk about
that scene where they coughs blood on her?
That's the best scene in the movie by far.
It is so startling and
really good.
Because what's happening in that scene that she is like in his face again? She's like, I'm not taking down these billboards. Fuck you. And then he coughs blood on her and she's instantly like humanized by the moment. She's caring for him, immediately springing into action. It's such a startling, dramatic moment. I one of the best of the year. Me.
That was one of the only moments in the film where I was like, these are people who know each other, who have lived in a town, who have interacted with each other in this real way. And the rest of it felt more pastiche to me. But that scene, I was bummed out then that he was not in the rest of the movie.
That is the movie where the rhetoric falls apart as soon as you start seeing humanizing moments, no matter who is on what side of the line. Like, the people that you're angry at are real people too. And of course, the people who you're angry at for good reasons because they hate black people or they're violent sociopaths like Sam Rockwell can also be real humans, but that doesn't let them off the hook. I don't think this movie lets anyone off the hook, whether, you know, I don't think it's equating Frances McDormand's actions with Sam Rockwell's actions. I don't think the bad people of the world are, you know, that Martin McDonagh is saying that good, bad and bad are kind of all the same. It's just all shades of anger, and that we can get caught up in anger and some people can escape and some people can't, and that I don't know, it's just like you don't see that as representation of true like existence without having to be such realistic quote-unquote character.
I think that theme tracks and makes sense to me, and there were definitely moments in individual scenes where I felt that coming through. Like, there's a later scene with Peter Dinklage where she's at dinner, and then there's a scene where John Hawkes shows up. Like, these characters kind of emerge and kind of bring that theme back over and over again. But it didn't, like, on a moment-by-moment and on a character track basis, it didn't work for me. And I wanted to go back really quickly to Woody Harrelson because I don't think his whole suicide scene lasted half of an hour, but it sure felt like it did because it lasted forever. His voiceover lasts forever. And Abby Cornish is so terribly cast as his wife. It makes no
sense. He has like
50
letters that he leaves that are all in voiceover to tell you how to feel afterwards.
What?
I was like,
yeah, and then his wife is Australian and 15 years younger than him for no reason, and she gets one big scene and then disappears from the rest of the movie. I think Abby Cornish has been great in a lot of things. She makes no sense in this movie. It's incredibly distracting.
I have no defense of that.
Did you think his suicide scene was good?
Yeah, I thought his suicide scene was good. Why would I think it's bad? I didn't think it was endless like that. I mean,
I didn't mind the suicide scene, but it is really weird how there's this complex character in a relationship that we're just managing to start feeling out, and then he dies, and then you can't question anything he puts in those fucking voiceovers because, oh no, the sheriff's dead. Like, even the Francis McDormand character that has all this shit against him is still like, oh, that darn sheriff. He paid for my billboards. And so that is why when the final voiceover, he's like, Sam Rockwell's character, I know you're like a good person deep inside there. The subtext is that is, so I helped you cover up torturing a black person, because I really have this sincere belief that your biggest crime is just that you're an idiot. And then the movie's like, yep, that's his biggest crime. Let's light him on fire so he could be born again, the non-idiot hero. And I'm like,
this is the fallacy that everything that people say is not necessarily true. I don't think you're just supposed to take everything in this movie at face value. Woody Harrelson, I mean, there's an argument that he's selfish for like abandoning his family and doing this. There's an argument that he's full of shit when he says that to Sam Rockwell, because he gives him this like dose of inspiration where he can look around and find the clues and do this. You know, they hint at that the killer of Mildred's daughter might be right under their nose the whole time if they just look around, and Sam Rockwell can use his brain finally to solve a crime. He fails. It's not true. Nothing is true.
That's
sentimental crap is not built into this movie. It's a gloss that needs to be stripped away to find truth.
So then it's just a whole bunch of idiots that I'm supposed to hate the whole time.
It's not
and
a bunch
movie's
of idiots
trick,
that you're
the,
to hate.
The movie's about... trick is revealing that I was right to hate
no,
them.
No, I think like I mean, I think the tone that it ends planet. On in the car with them is what it's going for and is a good tone to strike, where you've got them kind of maybe they're going to go off on this ridiculous, violent quest to try to solve problems that they won't actually solve, and maybe they won't. And they've got the potential to kind of turn themselves around and do better, but we don't know if they will. And that makes total sense to me with the story that they're telling. For me, the getting there had a lot of problems.
Yeah, I don't want to make how angry I'm sounding make it sound like I didn't like this movie. This is the experience I like for my cinema. It's like I went in, it challenged me. I'm still not sure how I felt about it. I just think that there's some things here that rub me the wrong way as how to construct a character. But maybe it's because I wasn't supposed to be on the side the whole time. Maybe Patches is right.
No one's right or
you're
wrong,
gonna have to,
but I'm right.
You're going to have to figure it out by... they could figure it out on their own by go seeing Three Billboards over Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh, wow. We're going to leave it there?
Yeah, why not?
Mic drop.
Boom.
That Patches is going to keep yelling at us.
I'm not yelling. I'm just I'm two against one here. I gotta stick up for this movie.
I'm not on your side. I think you're like we're both. It's possible we're both reading too much into this movie. I don't know how much depth there is. Maybe it's my problem is that I skipped in Bruges and just saw Seven Psychopaths.
Oh, so I never saw Seven Psychopaths.
Yeah, let's see. Maybe I'm just missing.
I don't
a tone.
Really like that movie that much. But I do like
him. Just missing.
And I do like
here.
His plays. I mean, his plays are about awful people being awful to each other, and about. I mean,
maybe that's just something I enjoy with seeing more on the stage, because I also like stage plays about awful people being awful to each other. But maybe there's something about the artifice about that. It's all seemed so. Everyone is so selfish with their pain in this movie, and
yeah, that felt
you
very
just want
real.
To reach. Well, yeah, you want to reach in and be like. Isn't it obvious to anybody besides Peter Dinklage's character that you're all like in this cycle?
This is how Twitter feels.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're right about your reaction you're having to it. I'm just not sure any of it is like, I don't know if you can intentionally do that to an audience. So like, I think I'm still back to agreeing with Katie that it's kind of irresponsible to like try to pull all these triggers to get your story across, because then you end up with people like me. Who might have genuinely seen something he liked, but just feels sort of like icky about it.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. Thank you for listening. Leave us reviews. David will be back to mangle your names next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com. where you can listen to the episodes. You can share them with friends, because we know your friends will enjoy listening to this conversation about screaming about Three Billboards. And
not screaming.
No, not screaming. That was a good conversation. That was a good, lively fight in the world.
We're leaving ourselves.
We used to have to go to bars to do this.
Yeah. Five stars was helpful. fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can also find us on Facebook, where you could search Fighting in the War Room, find our Facebook page, connect with us, connect with other people, write on our wall, all the comments, all that stuff. You can find more of me on Twitter at DA7E, where I will pin my newest stuff for thethrillist.com. I think we got some Justice League stuff there. We're still talking about Justice League, right? Right, guys? Come on.
It was my lightning round question.
We did talk about it multiple times. Release the Snyder Cut. Remember, we're hashtag six for the six. See the movie six times in theaters to support Justice League so to make sure that all the heroes get their due. Six for the six.
Wow.
Justice League release Zack Snyder Cut. Down with Joss
Whedon. Five showings behind.
You just explained a Jordan Hoffman tweet from several hours ago. Explaining that joke. Hello, I am Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com and on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about a lot of things and answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of the disaster artist, what movie deserves a movie about how that movie was made?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Crazy, I know you.